"Hope to get up there by dark," he said. "Lead the way," Joe said. "Remember when I told you trouble always follows you around?" Neil asked. "Yep. Maybe it worked out in our favor this time." Joe made a U-turn and joined Sheriff Neil's entourage headed toward Saratoga.
"Yes, I remember him," Sheridan said. "He's a creepy guy, and we had to throw him off the ranch because he didn't have permission to put traps there. Mr. Gordon was worried that one of our ranch dogs would get hurt, you know?"
"Is it possible," Joe asked, "that McKnight was on the property the same week Kate was there, July 23rd to the 30th?
"I'm thinking," she said. "I can't say for sure. I know he was there in the middle of the summer, so it's possible. Mr. Gordon might remember."
Joe called the Silver Creek Ranch office, but Gordon wasn't in, so he left a message asking the GM if he could recall the specific week when McKnight was ordered off the property. A few bundled-up pedestrians on the sidewalk in Saratoga paused to watch the five-vehicle law enforcement caravan pass through town and out the other side.
"Tongues will be wagging before we get there," Sheridan observed.
They turned left at the junction of Highways 130 and 230 and started the climb to the snowy range. The sagebrush and rock formations in the foothills gave way to a long willow-choked flat where Brush Creek meandered, and two cow moose and a yearling calf watched them go by. The snow on either side of the road got deeper with every mile. Joe checked his rear-view mirror to discover that an additional four-wheel drive vehicle had slipped into the convoy behind the truck pulling the snowmobiles. He couldn't see who was inside until he took a turn into the trees and got a better angle. "Oh, no," he said aloud. "Billy Bloodworth and Sophie have joined us." He reported the interlopers to Sheriff Neil on the radio.
"He's the English reporter?" Neil asked.
"Yep, and Kate's sister."
"That son of a bitch should have turned those photos over to us instead of putting them on the internet," Neil said, with the typical disdain cops had for the media in general. "Did you know it's common for those UK types to pay people for stories and photos? I didn't know that until today."
"He's gonna want to go along with us," Joe said. "He wants an exclusive before any other reporters show up." Neil grunted and signed off. Joe realized Nate had said nothing since they'd spoken to Sheriff Neil and joined the procession south.
"What are you thinking?" he asked his friend.
"I'm thinking this new development really doesn't work in my overall conspiracy theory," Nate said.
"Aha," Joe said, with a hint of glee. A large turnaround had been plowed at the end of the highway so that unsuspecting drivers could easily loop around and head back to Saratoga instead of going over the top of the mountain towards Centennial and Laramie. There was enough room to use the alcove as a staging area for the snowmobiles. Joe parked next to Neil's vehicle. Joe watched Billy Bloodworth erupt from his rented SUV as soon as he parked it with the others. Sophie stayed inside. He was at Sheriff Neil's Tahoe as Neil climbed out. Joe left his truck running while he got out to join them.
"I must go with you,"
Bloodworth said to the sheriff. His voice was unusually high-pitched and frantic.
"Not possible," the sheriff said affably. "I'm not risking the safety of a civilian."
"I beg your pardon, sir,"
Bloodworth said as his eyes bulged.
"I'm not a civilian. I'm media, and therefore I've a right to report the news under the First Amendment."
"So you're American?" Neil asked him.
"I'm a British subject."
"Then have your queen send me a note," Neil drawled.
Joe looked away so he wouldn't laugh.
"You don't understand," Bloodworth pleaded. This is my narrative. This is my legacy.
Neil stared at Bloodworth for a moment. Show me in my mission as the sheriff of Carbon County that it's my job to help you with your legacy. Bloodworth turned to Joe.
Tell him this wouldn't even be happening without my reporting.
He's the sheriff, Joe said. It's his call. Neil said, You're welcome to stay here, though, and see what we find.
This is fucking outrageous, Bloodworth said.
Then, as if it had just occurred to him, he hugged himself and said,
It's cold as fuck.
Put on a coat, Neil said sourly, and try not to curse every time you open your mouth. What's wrong with you people? Bloodworth turned toward his rental, but stopped short when he saw Eli Jarrett being escorted by a deputy from the back door of the SUV.
Mr. Jarrett, Bloodworth said with venom, we had a deal to keep this information confidential until I could finish reporting the story.
Jarrett flushed and said, I don't even know what that means.
Fucking idiots,
Bloodworth spat, and pulled himself quickly inside his car and shut the door. Joe could see but not hear Sophie admonish him, and Bloodworth go on a rant with dancing hands and spittle flying on the inside of the driver's side window.
He's a little too tightly wound to go along, Neil said to Joe, and I doubt he's ever driven a snow machine.
Joe agreed. Twilight in the mountains brought a special kind of cold. It crept out from the darkness of the lodgepole pine forest where it had spent the daylight hours, and it slithered across the top of the snow to sting every inch of exposed human skin. Sounds became sharper, and the snow itself became a different texture that squeaked like nails on a chalkboard with every footfall. While the snowmobile rental owner backed each machine off the trailer one by one, Joe and the sheriff's crew pulled on snowmobile suits and exchanged their footwear for heavy snowmobile boots. Joe was grateful his coveralls had been in the back seat, and they were still warm from Sheridan's body heat. His helmet, though, had been in his gearbox in the bed of his pickup, and it was as cold as a block of ice when he pulled it on. The plastic face shield fogged up instantly. He approached Neil as the sheriff struggled to fit into his suit with Sheriff written in yellow across the back. Do you have a spare for my partner? Joe asked, nodding toward Nate in his truck.
I might have, Neil said. Who is he?
He's a guy we'd rather have along with us, Joe said.
We're running out of machines.
He can ride on the back of mine. Neil gestured to the snowmobile rental operator.
Check with him, he said. Tell him to put it on my quickly growing tab.
Thanks, Joe said.
What about me? Sheridan asked, as Joe handed Nate an extra-large black snowmobile suit that had snowy range sleds embroidered over the breast pocket.
Call your mom and let her know what's going on, Joe said. She's gonna want to know. Thinking, so would Hanlon. But he'll be even more pleased, Joe thought, with a call that tells him we've solved the case. The still air filled with the acrid fumes of six idling snowmobiles. Sheriff Neil and his three deputies waited for everyone to straddle the machines and nod their helmets that they were ready to move out. Joe took a Polaris 550 wide track LX because it was extra long and could seat two people. Nate settled in behind him, snug, but not embarrassingly snug, he thought. Eli Jarrett sat alone, revving his engine. He was bookended by two deputies on their snowmobiles. Joe had spent hundreds of hours patrolling on sleds, and although he wasn't an expert, he considered himself competent.
He could tell when he watched the deputies by the way they took in the gauges and got the feel for their hand throttles that they were far from experts themselves. Sheriff Neal rode up beside Joe and raised his face shield.
"Keep a close eye on Jarrett," he said. "Keep right on him. This might be a ruse to get us up here where he knows the mountains and the trails so he can get away from us and hightail it out of here. I don't think my guys could keep up with him, and I damn well know I can't."
"Gotcha. What is our plan when we get to the cabin?" Joe said.
"I'm working on that," Neal said, and slid his mask down.
Chapter 19. At the same time, Wiley Fry arrived at the Encampment Lumber Mill for his overnight shift wearing insulated coveralls, Sorrel pack boots, and his wool rancher cap. It was 8 below 0 and falling by the minute. He parked his pickup facing the warm wall of the conical burner to keep the motor warm through the night, and he grabbed his lunch from the passenger seat to take inside so it wouldn't freeze solid. As he lumbered toward the burner shack, he felt his phone vibrate in his shirt breast pocket, and he stopped to check the screen. Unknown number. The second time that night, he ignored it and quickly put his phone back and zipped up the coveralls so the temperature wouldn't make the zipper lock up. Even though management would disapprove, Fry wanted to start up the front-end loader as soon as he could after he arrived to transfer the waste and sawdust from the mill itself and shove it into the burner all at one time. Management had told him to feed the fire incrementally every couple of hours throughout his shift, but it was a pain in the butt to put on his coveralls and walk up to the mill itself 3 or 4 times a night when he could do it all at once. This way, he had more leisure time in the shack, and he could maybe even get in a nap, he figured. Sure, the temperature of the burner might exceed its recommended threshold, Fry knew that, but he also knew it was supposed to get to 25 below after midnight, and some extra heat probably wouldn't damage the inner workings of the structure, and it would keep the shack toasty warm. He placed his lunch on a shelf next to the steel burner wall so it would keep warm. As he did so, his phone went off again. He cursed and chose to punch it up. If nothing else, he could tell the unknown caller to fuck off.
"Who is this?" he asked.
"Answer your phone. You know who it is."
The gravelly voice was unmistakable.
"I didn't answer because I didn't recognize the number."
"I've got a new phone. I'd suggest you get one, too. In fact, do it. Get more than one."
"I've got a phone," Wiley said.
"Jesus, you're dense. What I'm saying is I want you to get a couple of prepaid disposable phones to have on hand in the future. We can't have anyone pulling up a record of calls from me to you. Got it? So go out and get a new phone and text the number to me. I'll call that number the next time."
"You want me to get a burner?" Wiley asked.
"Yeah. I didn't say burner because I didn't want you to get it confused with where you work."
"I'm not stupid."
The man chuckled at that. Wiley ignored it.
"Where am I supposed to get burners?"
"Try the Come and Go. They've got a rack of them. If you don't want to do that, go to the Walmart in Rollins."
Wiley hesitated, said, "I guess."
"Do it."
"Okay, okay."
After a beat, the man said,
"We'll be ready to make another delivery run tomorrow night, so have that new phone handy."
"Tomorrow?"
he asked, only to stall for time and screw up his courage for what he was about to ask.
"That's what I said."
"Well, I wanted to talk to you about that. I think I need more money if we're going to keep doing this."
The silence on the other end made the hair on the back of Wiley's neck prick up. Wiley said,
"I'm running a big risk here. I've got kids with medical bills."
It was a lie.
If his kids got sick, his ex took them to the free county clinic. But Wiley had his eye on a new long-distance rifle, the Hammer. Chambered in 375 Shytac and manufactured by Gunworks in Cody, Wyoming, it weighed nearly 21 pounds and could hit a target over 2,000 yards away. Wiley had watched the video on the Gunworks site dozens of times, and it gave him an erection, plus the look of the rifle itself with its bipod, night force scope, and folding stock was completely badass. And it cost over $12,000.
You don't know who you're dealing with, do you? I'm not a man who negotiates after we have a deal,
the man said finally.
That's not how I operate.
I thought at first it was a one-time thing, Wiley said, his voice rising in register. You didn't tell me you'd be calling me every 10 days to 2 weeks. More silence. It made Wiley nervous. He realized he was sweating inside his coveralls. Look, he said, how about we go with what you've been paying, but just for tomorrow night? After that, if we go forward, we need to have better terms.
Is that right?
Just think about it, okay? Wiley knew how lame he sounded.
We'll be there between 2:15 and 3:30 as usual, the man said.
He didn't even address Wiley's proposal.
In the meantime, delete your phone records and my old contact number from your phone.
Seriously?
And not just that. I need you to reformat your phone completely, so it looks like it did when you took it out of the box.
I'll lose everything, Wiley complained. All my contacts and my game apps.
Do it, or you're gonna wish you did. And leave your old phone on your desk tomorrow when we show up. I want to make sure you did everything right.
What's going on? Why are we going through all of this if you don't have hazardous materials?
Shut the fuck up, Wiley, the man snapped. Just do what I tell you.
I'll text you my new number tomorrow, Wiley said with a sigh of resignation. He could put up with the abuse if it meant he could get closer to that Hammer. The call dropped and Wiley stared at his phone for a moment. He took his hat off and ran his fingers through his hair. His scalp was moist. He didn't have a good feeling about the conversation. From behind him, Jeb Pryor said,
I overheard some of that, Wiley. What the hell do you have going on the side at my mill?
Wiley turned slowly. Pryor, the owner, had come into the shack and shut the door behind him. Wiley hadn't noticed him because he'd been so focused on the call itself. He didn't know how long old man Pryor had been there or how much he'd heard.
Nothing, Wiley lied. I've got nothing going on.
Pryor looked him over. Wiley just stood there, his sphincter contracting. He knew his face was flushed.
I think you and me need to have a little talk, Pryor said.
Chapter 20. The sun dropped below the summit of the Sierra Madre range at their backs as the snowmobiles tore across a long meadow toward the forest. Joe glanced at his watch, a half hour left of daylight. He wished it didn't get dark so early in the winter. Eli Jarrett roared up an untracked logging road on his snowmobile, followed by the two deputies assigned to him, then Joe and Nate. Sheriff Neal and his undersheriff trailed them all and fell farther and farther behind. The two deputies behind Jarrett were struggling to keep up with him on the flats, Joe thought. Once the old road started to climb and twist through the forest, he didn't know if they could stay with him. Joe goosed the Polaris, and it responded with a leap forward to close the gap. Jarrett was an aggressive snowmobile driver who knew how to use his weight and the power of the machine itself to get farther and farther ahead. Joe didn't see the man look over his shoulder once to see if the others were still with him.
"Stay in his track," Nate shouted from behind Joe.
Joe knew what he meant. Jarrett had been up the road the weekend before and had packed down and groomed a path. Although that path had been obscured by several recent snowfalls, it was still down there as a base for the snow machines. Just a few feet to either the right or the left was several feet of pure powder snow. The hidden but groomed path served as a kind of land bridge through the fluffy snow. Joe hoped the deputies knew that. The deputy directly behind Jarrett apparently didn't, though, and when he took a turn too wide, he went flying off the road into the meadow, where his snowmobile immediately bogged down. The front sleds of his machine nosed into the sky, and the back sank down. The second deputy saw what had happened to his colleague and slowed to assist him. Joe whipped by him and closed the gap behind Jarrett. He couldn't tell if the man was intentionally trying to leave the others behind, as the sheriff had suggested, or if he just naturally rode like a bat out of hell. Jarrett had to slow down once they were in the shadows of the lodgepole forest, because the narrow road took several sharp turns. Joe stayed with him, aided by Nate on the back, who also knew when to use his weight to keep the machine on track. The high-pitched whine of the snowmobiles was muted by his helmet, but it reverberated through the crowded trees and enveloped him in a halo of motorized buzz. The forest was dense on both sides, with baseball bat-like trunks so close together Joe wasn't sure he could leave the road and maneuver his machine through the trees even if he wanted to. He knew that if he tried to do that, he'd need to relocate the shotgun that straddled his seat. There wasn't enough space between the trees for the length of the weapon from muzzle to butt. The beam of the headlamp on his Polaris strobe through the trees with each turn, and he caught glimpses of Jarrett's red taillight up ahead of him. Despite the suit and helmet, he could feel icy fingers of cold creeping in through his collar and cuffs. The heated handles of the machine beaded with melted snow that had sifted down through the branches like fine flour. Before they broke out of the thick stand of trees, Jarrett decelerated suddenly, and Joe nearly ran him over. He was able to turn slightly at the last moment so that his left ski missed the back of Jarrett's machine by inches.
"What?" Joe asked him after he turned off his motor. Jarrett had as well. It was so cold that when Joe breathed the raw air in, he felt ice crystals form in his nostrils. After being pummeled by the high-pitched whine of the Polaris and the reverberation in the trees, the sudden quiet seemed awesome. But it wasn't totally silent. Joe could hear the remaining machines getting closer. Jarrett lifted his face shield and pointed a gloved finger a half-mile ahead through an opening toward where another dense pine forest began. The light was so low that the tree wall to which he was gesturing looked black.
"The cabin I saw is right in the middle of that timber," Jarrett said. "Straight up the road we're on."
Joe couldn't see any lights from an occupied structure, but he thought he caught a whiff of wood smoke and perhaps a cooking smell.
"Let's wait until the sheriff gets here," Joe said.
"If he ever does," Nate grumbled.
When Neil finally joined them, he pulled in behind the other five machines and killed his motor. The snow was so deep on both sides of the trail that no one had climbed off their machines for fear they'd sink down past their thighs and have to climb back on.
"What do you think?" Neil asked Jarrett. "Are we close enough to walk in if we stay on the groomed part of the trail?"
"I guess," Jarrett shrugged.
Joe thought he didn't seem very enthusiastic about the idea. Joe said, "Sheriff, these sleds are loud. If he's still up there with her, he's likely heard us coming. I think we can assume we've lost the element of surprise. Neil nodded in agreement. He said, "Let's bull rush the son of a bitch." His deputies all seemed to agree. Neil said, "Safety first, gentlemen. I don't want anybody getting hurt, including McKnight. He's armed, because everybody is, but we don't know if he's desperate or dangerous. Remember, we have probable cause to ask him some questions, but we don't have a warrant for his arrest. Got that?"
"Got it," his men grumbled, even though Joe could tell they were spoiling for a confrontation after coming all this way up the mountain to rescue Kate.
Neil said, "We want to avoid a standoff or a hostage situation if we can. But I don't want him getting away, either. Just remember your training, officers. We don't want an incident."
He rose on his machine so he could see Jarrett in the dying light.
"Eli, is there a door in the back of that place?"
Jarrett took a minute to think.
"I don't think so. Just windows. But don't hold me to that."
Neil pointed to one of his deputies and said, "You go around back when we get there and make sure no one comes out and runs." Then to the rest, "We'll all fan out when we get to the cabin. Remember to get behind your snowmobile and use it as cover, or find a tree or something. I'll do the talking."
To Jarrett, Neil said, "Stay here, and don't even think about running. If you do, we'll track you down like a dog."
Jarrett nodded. Neil looked at everyone else to make sure they were paying attention, then tipped his head forward so his face shield slid down. Then he unzipped his snowmobile suit so he could access his weapon. The deputies unsheathed M4 rifles and shotguns and armed their weapons. Joe racked a shell into the chamber of his Remington Wingmaster 12-gauge and checked to make sure the safety was engaged. Behind him, Nate drew his .454 and placed it casually on his thigh.
"Start your machines and mount up, boys," Neil said. "Go, go, go!"
His voice was muffled and tinny because of his closed face shield. Joe tried to swallow, but his mouth was too dry with anxiety. Since Jarrett had been ordered to stay back, Joe led the charge to the cabin. He kept his front skis squarely in the middle of the old road where the trail was and hoped the others behind him stayed in the track he made. His headlight lit up the trunks of the stand of trees and he plunged into them. The road started a slow bend to the right.
"They're still all with us," Nate shouted.
Joe didn't know how far the cabin was within the forest, but he felt its presence dead ahead. And it was. He saw it all at once. A small, dark, box-shaped structure opening up on a clear meadow that glowed with ambient moon and starlight. There was a dim yellow light in one of the front windows, and a curl of smoke from the top of a stone chimney. Snow was tramped down around the cabin itself, and a path with 3-foot walls led to a detached outhouse. Joe shot by an open loafing shed filled with animal hides stretched and mounted on plywood sheets and on the interior walls. He thought, "A trapper lives here." When he turned straight toward the cabin, his headlight swept across the front window. He got a glimpse of blonde hair near the bottom of the sill, just like the photo, he thought. Exactly like the photo.
"See that?" he hollered over his shoulder to Nate.
"Saw something," Nate responded.
Then he felt Nate's hard grip.
"There he goes," Nate yelled.
Joe looked to the right in time to see the headlight of a snowmobile flashing through the stand of trees, headed the direction from which they'd all just come. He couldn't get a good look at the driver. There were 2 orange star-shaped flashes followed by sharp cracks. McKnight was firing at them as he fled. Joe had no idea where the rounds had ended up. Nate's weapon thundered, and Joe felt the recoil rock the Polaris. The slug missed the driver but smacked into the trunks of several trees, and a shower of snow from the branches turned the grove into a man-made blizzard.
"Miss that bastard," Nate hissed.
Suddenly, Neil was beside Joe as his men raced around them toward the cabin as ordered. Two of the deputies bailed off their snowmobiles and hunkered behind them as they aimed weapons toward the structure. The third raced around back to make sure no one escaped through a window.
"What the hell happened?"
Neil asked Joe.
Joe nodded to the grove of trees. McKnight heard us coming and took off. He shot and Nate returned fire.
"It sounded like a cannon."
"McKnight is behind us," Joe said. "He's headed back down the mountain."
"Did he have Kate with him?"
"Not that I saw. I think she's still inside."
Neil reached into his saddlebag and withdrew an extra-long 5-cell maglite. He flashed the beam on the front of the window and choked it down to reveal the back of a blonde head.
"She's not moving,"
Neil said.
"Not good," Joe said.
Neil accelerated past him and ordered the two deputies in front to chase McKnight and arrest him. Joe couldn't hear the words over the burbling snowmobiles, but he could tell by the sheriff's actions and the reaction of his men what had just occurred. The deputies climbed back on their machines and drove them across the meadow. They entered the stand of trees where McKnight had fired at them to cut McKnight's track. Guns drawn, Joe and Nate followed Sheriff Neil and his undersheriff onto the rough wood porch of the cabin. They covered him as he shouldered through the front door.
"Oh,"
he heard Neil say from inside. Then,
"Oh, shit."
Joe entered, and his initial impression of what he saw at the other end of Neil's flashlight beam was that it looked like a corpse. She was seated in a hard-backed chair with her back to the window and her long, bare legs spread out straight. She wore spiked heels and lacy black lingerie. Her arms hung limp down at her side. The beam paused on her face, billowing blonde, shoulder-length hair, large blue eyes, a pert nose, and a wide-open, O-shaped mouth. Neil said,
"We came all this way to find McKnight's damn sex doll."
Joe lowered his shotgun and briefly closed his eyes. The tension he felt morphed into humiliation.
"They're going to be talking about this one for years," Neil said.
They meant everyone, Joe knew. Locals, voters, the media, other law enforcement people, not to mention Chief of Staff Hanlon, Governor Allen, and the British Consulate.
"Well," Nate said, "at least my conspiracy theory is back on the table."
"What theory is that?" Neil asked.
His voice was suddenly weary. Nate ignored the question, but shot Joe a knowing look as he expelled the empty cartridge from his 5-shot revolver and replaced it with a live round. Sheridan had heard shots several minutes before as they echoed through the mountains. Crack, crack, boom. She turned the fan down on the truck heater so she could listen better, but there were no follow-up gunshots. She glanced over at the other occupied vehicles in the lot. The snowmobile operator was sitting in the cab of his truck, but she could tell by the blue glow on the side of his face that he was talking on his phone. There was no indication he'd heard anything. Sophie and Billy Bloodworth were still in the middle of an argument and hadn't heard it either. Their interior light was on. She could see Sophie pointing her finger at Bloodworth and jabbing the air. Bloodworth theatrically covered his ears with his hands for a moment and rolled his eyes toward the sky. She cracked the driver's side window an inch and felt the cold stab into the cab. The whine of an approaching snowmobile was faint at first, but it grew stronger. Just one snowmobile returning?
Her dad's pickup pointed toward the wall of snow where the sheriff and his team had departed. She assumed whoever was coming was using that same trail. After a minute, she saw a yellow glow flash through the treetops. Then a single headlight appeared over the embankment of snow, and the snowmobile descended into the parking area. The driver paused at the sight of all the vehicles, then apparently made up his mind. The machine launched forward and was coming right at her. The snowmobile rental operator opened his door as the machine and driver shot by him. The interior light from his truck gave Sheridan a glimpse of the driver. She recognized McKnight's face through his plastic face mask. He looked angry and determined. She raised her hand so the bright light wouldn't blind her as it got closer. McKnight seemed to sense that if he got through the parked vehicles, he'd be home free. The roar grew, and Sheridan could see that the man was going to attempt to squeeze through the opening between her dad's truck and Sheriff Neal's SUV. It was a narrow chute. She unlatched the passenger door and waited until he was almost beside her before she kicked it wide open. With a bang that rocked the pickup, the door took out McKnight's windshield and threw the man to the ground. His machine continued on for 15 feet behind them before foundering in a drift. She scrambled outside. McKnight lay motionless on his back with his arms flung out as if making a snow angel. His face mask was spiderwebbed with cracks. A semi-automatic pistol lay on the packed snow a yard from McKnight's outstretched hand. She lunged forward and picked it up. The steel was cold in her bare hands. Two other snowmobiles appeared on the trail. She was grateful they were being driven by deputies. McKnight was starting to recover from the impact, and he groaned and writhed in the snow. She pointed his pistol at him and told him to be still. Billy Bloodworth's camera flashed repeatedly somewhere behind her. One of the deputies shut off his motor, climbed from his machine, and said with admiration, "Damn, girl, that was a good trick." Chapter 21. "This'll be fun," Joe said sourly as he punched in Hanlon's cell phone number. It was an hour and a half after they had all descended from McKnight's cabin, and Joe had finally been cleared by Sheriff Neal to depart from the parking lot at the end of the road. Joe and Sheridan had agreed to drive to the sheriff's office in Rawlins the next day to give formal statements. Nate didn't commit. An ambulance with flashing lights was ahead of them on the highway with McKnight inside. The preliminary diagnosis from the EMTs was that the trapper had a broken jaw, a cracked clavicle, and upper body contusions. As he examined McKnight, one of the EMTs had said simply, "Lawsuit." The call to Hanlon went straight to voicemail, for which Joe was grateful. He said, "The lead about the cabin turned out to be a dry hole. It wasn't Kate. It wasn't even a person in that photo. I can explain when we talk, but we'll close down that channel of the investigation and start fresh in the morning." Joe ended the call and dropped the phone to his lap.
"I bet you regret that choice of words," Nate said. "Dry hole."
Joe glanced up at the rearview mirror to see Sheridan looking away. She pretended she didn't know what Nate meant.
"I could have phrased it better," Joe said.
Despite the heater running full blast, it was cold inside the truck. The passenger door had been dented by the impact of McKnight's crash, and it wouldn't close tightly. Joe had secured it to the door frame as best he could with duct tape, but the icy wind whistled inside the cab. The scene in the parking lot had been barely controlled chaos once Sheriff Neal and his colleagues returned from the mountain. They were drawn to where Sheridan stood over McKnight in the snow by the flashes of Billy Bloodworth's camera. Joe wouldn't soon forget the image of Sheriff Neal barking out orders to call for an ambulance with the blow-up doll pinned horizontally under his right arm. Bloodworth took several shots of that, too, and the sheriff ordered him to get the hell out of my crime scene. Bloodworth and Sophie sped away toward town, but not before the reporter got quotes from a couple of the deputies about what had happened at the cabin and what they'd found. Joe assumed Bloodworth was on his phone dictating the scoop to his editor in London. He'd likely upload the photos he'd taken as soon as he got back to Saratoga. Joe parked next to Sheridan's company pickup at the Silver Creek Ranch so she could go back to her apartment. He said, "You were great up there." She rolled her eyes. "I injured an innocent pervert." "Don't forget that he took a couple of shots at us," Joe said. "Sheriff Neal will probably charge him with using deadly force against a law enforcement officer. McKnight's not exactly home free."
"Will he sue all you guys?"
"Probably."
"Will he win?"
"Probably." "What a night," Sheridan said. As she climbed out, she patted Nate goodbye on his shoulder and said to Joe,
"For what it's worth, I still think Kate is alive."
"You do?"
"Love you, Dad."
"Love you. Call your mother."
"Follow me into the wolf," Nate said as he pushed through the tape holding his door closed so he could get to his vehicle. "We'll dump your truck and you can get in with me. There's something I want to show you."
Joe raised his eyebrows. "Does this have something to do with your conspiracy theory?" Nate nodded. 15 minutes later, as the glow from Saratoga smudged the northern horizon and Nate's taillights were ahead, Hanlon called back. Joe took a deep pull of icy air and answered.
"A fucking doll?"
Joe didn't say, "literally." Instead, he said, "Word travels fast." A dispatcher at DOT listened to the whole thing on the radio and informed the governor of your latest screw-up. He didn't sound enraged, Joe thought. He sounded cold and businesslike. "I tried to call you earlier," Joe said.
"I was on the phone with him at the time," Hanlon said. "We're trying to decide if we're going to cancel the press conference and come out looking like we're idiots, or have it anyway and come out looking like we're idiots. Plus, it sounds like we'll get sued by the innocent trapper you attacked."
"We didn't attack the trapper," Joe said while trying to keep his voice calm. "If you'll recall, I advised against the press conference until we could confirm the photograph," Joe said.
"I don't," Hanlon snapped. "Do you remember when I told you the governor wasn't happy with you? Now he just wants you gone. You are officially a non-person as far as this administration is concerned."
Joe let those words sink in. Before he could reply, Hanlon continued.
"This is going to make us all look as stupid as you are when it gets out. And it will, thanks to the reporter on the scene. It'll go viral. Governor Allen and law enforcement in the state of Wyoming will be the subject of jokes, thanks to you."
Joe cut in. "When you say he wants me gone, he means I can go back to my district?"
"He doesn't give a shit where you go. As long as he never hears your name again, you're fired, Pickett. We'll send over the paperwork to Game and Fish first thing tomorrow."
Joe was stunned. Images of Mary Beth, Sheridan, April, and Lucy flashed before his eyes.
"Maybe we'll change the focus of the press conference," Hanlon said, apparently thinking out loud. "The governor can announce that he's canning the incompetent investigator leading the search for Kate and redoubling his efforts to find out what happened to her. That way he comes out looking like a determined man of action."
"Yeah, I like that."
then to Joe. Lose my number. If you call again, I won't pick up. You've done enough damage already.
We aren't done, Joe said, suddenly angry. You need to answer a couple of questions first.
Hanlon scoffed. You don't get this chain of command thing, do you? 10 seconds. You've got 10 seconds.
Why did your office clean out Pollock's house and take his keys after he left?
5 seconds.
What did you do to Pollock to make him leave?
2 seconds.
Why did the governor send me down here?
We're done.
Have a nice life.
And the line went dead.
Chapter 22. 19 miles north of Saratoga, Joe saw the sea of blinking red lights as they emerged over the horizon. There were so many of them that the stars faded in the night sky and the untrammeled snowfields in the foreground glowed pink. Nate eased to the shoulder of the highway and then turned at a 90-degree angle into the deep snow. When the front end of his Yukon began to bog down, he switched it to four-wheel drive, and it lurched forward until the headlights illuminated the top three of a four-strand barbed wire fence. Joe didn't ask what they were doing. He was still too numb from the conversation he'd had with Hanlon to focus.
Look away as I break the law, Nate said.
His friend climbed down out of the vehicle with a well-used fencing tool he'd stashed in the driver's side door compartment. Joe watched without comprehension as Nate strode through the knee-high snow and pulled the staples from four posts until the wires sagged down. Then he re-entered the Yukon, dropped the staples into the ashtray for later, and drove over the top of the fence. After he cleared the wires, Nate accelerated, and the Yukon lurched forward. Joe braced himself as they broke through snowdrifts and ground over tall sagebrush that scraped along the undercarriage of the SUV. After a few minutes, they began to climb a steep hill that had blown nearly clear of snow. The red lights had vanished from the horizon, but the illuminated sky was dead ahead. Finally, Joe asked, "Where are we going?"
"To the top."
Joe nodded.
"What's wrong with you, anyway?"
Nate asked as they powered up toward the summit.
"You haven't said anything since you got in. You didn't even give me a hard time about taking that fence down like you usually do."
Joe had trouble saying the words. He cleared his throat. "Hanlon found out about the botched raid and he fired me. He said the governor wants me gone."
"I'm not surprised."
Joe turned to him. Nate was concentrating on driving the Yukon up the hill and avoiding boulders. He didn't even glance over.
"You're not?"
Joe asked.
"It was a matter of time."
"What are you talking about?" Nate said,
"Sometimes you get so close to the case you're working on, you can't see what's going on around you. I don't say this to insult you, but it's something I've observed over the years. It can be an asset that you're so bullheaded, but sometimes it works to your disadvantage. One might think that after you being in the government for so many years, you'd be more cynical, but that's why I like you, Joe. You aren't cynical. What I am is confused."
"That too.
Where are we going?"
"Up.
Until we can't go up any farther without going down."
Joe paused for a second. "Have you ever considered talking like a normal human?"
"Niet,"
Nate said. Before he could ask Nate to explain further, the Yukon broke over the top of the summit, and the windshield filled with the blinking red lights. They were more intense than they'd been before because Nate had chosen a location where they could see everything. The Buck Brush Wind Energy Project stretched across the vast valley as far as Joe could see. The blinking lights on the top of each 250-foot turbine made him wince. Wind buffeted the Yukon and rocked it, and the interior of the vehicle filled with a kind of low, subsonic hum from the turbine blades that spun in the dark. Below the blinking lights, spread across hundreds of acres, were the lone yellow lights from line shacks and maintenance buildings. They were tiny compared to the steel structures that rose before them.
"You're looking at the largest wind energy construction site in the world," Nate said. "It cost $5 billion worth of tax breaks and government subsidies to build it, and it exists to fulfill other government mandates about using a certain percentage of green energy thousands of miles away. It's being built so the beautiful people in California can keep their houses cool and their swimming pools heated. Plus, they won't have to get all stressed out about creating their own electrical power and impacting the planet. That they can see, anyway. Out of sight, out of mind, as long as the lights stay on."
Joe smiled and shook his head. "Don't beat around the bush, Nate. Tell me what you really think about it." Nate actually growled in response. But Joe couldn't believe the size and scope of the construction in front of them. The moon and the starlight lit up an immense grid of roads that linked up the bases of hundreds of turbines, and the roads glowed pink as well. A single vehicle miles below drove slowly down one of the roads.
"See that truck down there?"
Nate asked while he pointed.
"I do." "Watch where it does and where it goes."
He handed Joe a pair of binoculars and Joe focused in.
He didn't know why. The truck was too far to see clearly.
It was light-colored, and it moved slowly.
"What am I looking for?" Joe asked.
"You'll know it when you see it. Watch what it does when it goes from the base of one turbine to another."
Joe watched. The truck kept going straight and didn't turn toward the base of the nearest turbine. It drove straight past the second turnoff as well.
"Crap," Nate said. "We picked the wrong night."
"The wrong night for what?"
"The wrong night for my theory to fall into place right in front of your eyes. That's not the truck I was looking for. It looks like they're not out tonight."
Joe lowered the binoculars to his lap.
"Your theory?"
"I'll get to that," Nate said. "But first, let's talk about you and Governor Allen."
"Go on."
"I told you I'm acquainted with a few Falconers around Big Piney, right? Guys who knew Coulter Allen when he was a rancher and before he became a politician."
"Yep,"
Nate said.
"They knew the guy when he was filthy rich and arrogant. And they knew him when the bottom fell out of all of his investments. But he didn't want anyone to know that fact. When it happened, he'd already decided he was going to run for governor. And all of a sudden, he didn't have the money to pull it off on his own. No one could know, though, or it would have destroyed the illusion of his candidacy. Who would vote for a financial failure, especially when the whole idea behind the guy was that he was a winner?"
Joe nodded for Nate to go on.
"So Allen needed backers with enough money to fund him and maintain the illusion. He needed backers who would stay in the background."
Nate paused and said,
"He found two of them, and you can bet he owes them now."
"Who are these people?"
"When you find out who one of them is, you'll know why you were sent down here to Saratoga to fail. It isn't easy firing state employees. There has to be a good reason."
Joe sat up. "What do you mean I was sent down here to fail?
The governor said he wanted me to be his range rider like I was for Rulon.
Don't be naive, Joe, Nate said cruelly. Alan wants to get as far away from Rulon as he can. He doesn't want anyone comparing him to the last governor because deep down Alan is insecure. He wants to get rid of anyone who might be loyal to the ex-governor, but he has to do it in a way that doesn't get his hands dirty.
Joe started to rebut what Nate said, but it hit him. The strange disappearance of Pollock and the looting of Pollock's records. That cleared the deck and prevented Joe from knowing what the former game warden was working on. The robbery of the case file from his room at the Wolf let someone know for sure why he was down there. The planned press conference, even though Kate could not be positively identified. The pressure from Hanlon. The fact that he'd been sent out of his district to take over the case from the DCI in the first place. All had contributed to the debacle that had occurred at the trapper's cabin, and all had helped establish a pattern of incompetence and failure if spun properly. Joe said, "Even if what you say is true, that's an awful lot of trouble to go through just to get rid of one game warden."
"It is," Nate said. "And my guess is that Alan didn't figure it all out by himself and then set it into motion. He's not that smart. He turned to a guy who knows how to work the system to do his dirty work."
"Hanlon," Joe said.
"Bingo. He's been pulling the strings like a puppet master."
Joe sat back. He was hurt and tried not to show it. "But why me, other than I worked for Governor Rulon?"
"Think about it, Joe. Think about the backers. One of them asked for a quid pro quo, something that backer insisted on before a check was written."
Joe started to ask who, but then it all made sense.
"Missy," Joe said. "Your mother-in-law," Nate said. "She has the means, and she wants you to fail. That way, Mary Beth will finally see the light that she married a loser."
Joe moaned. It was insane, but it fit. Missy Van Curen was nothing if not diabolical.
"How do you know it was her?" Joe said, while the Yukon rocked in a sudden burst of wind. "My Falconer friend saw the two of them together a week or so before he formally announced his campaign. All they knew was that she was some rich lawyer's wife from Jackson Hole. They didn't make the connection, but I did. She's always wanted to bust up your marriage so Mary Beth and the girls can live with her in Jackson Hole, high style."
"It won't work," Joe said.
"I know my wife. Missy doesn't appreciate or understand her, and she never has." "True, but that won't stop her," Nate said. "Missy wants to finish you off. She's relentless, and she's getting crazier by the year."
Joe knew that to be true. Nevertheless, he felt a chill roll through him. "I'm a 48-year-old, soon-to-be, ex-game warden with one girl in college and the other about to start," he said. "How am I going to support my family? I don't have a plan B." Nate nodded and pursed his lips. He didn't disagree.
"Why didn't you tell me?" Joe asked. "You asked me not to."
Joe rolled his head back and moaned. After a few minutes of silence, Joe asked, "Who was the other backer?" Nate chinned toward Buckbrush.
"You're looking at it."
After that sunk in, Joe winced and asked, "So, what's your conspiracy theory?"
"Do you really want to know?"
"That's why I asked."
"Are you sure?"
"Nate, I'm not in the mood."
Nate said, "You know all the elements. They're right in front of you. You just haven't put them together yet."
"Enlighten me,"
Joe said, trying to keep his annoyance with his friend tamped down. And for the next 20 minutes, Nate laid it out. When he was through, Joe said, "That's pretty crazy." Nate conceded that.
"Do you have a better one?"
"No."
"So how should we proceed?"
Joe thought about it for a minute, then said, "We keep going with the investigation as if nothing had happened tonight, as if I never even talked to Hanlon, and you didn't tell me about Missy's role in this. We just keep moving ahead. Because that's the last thing Missy or Hanlon or the governor or whoever has been following me will expect."
"How do we do it if you've been fired?"
Nate asked.
"It won't be official until they notify my director and they send me the paperwork. It's Saturday night, so the administrative staff at HQ won't be in the office until Monday morning. Plus, I'm not sure they know exactly where to send it. My townhouse in Saddlestring, the Hotel Wolf. The wheels of state government turn really, really slow. That can work in our favor." A grin spread across Nate's face.
"I like it,"
he said.
"And we'll come back here every night until we've got them?"
"Yep."
"When we nail them, all bets are off,"
Nate said.
"I'm going to go yell."